proposal from the Office of Higher Education to resolve this issue after 2 years, which is great. And what page is Article 5 on?
I'm looking, Madam Chair.
31.
It's on 31.
31, okay.
I'm sure this issue has been before our committee for several years. There's been a task force that got together and put together a big report that came out, I think, last February. And this article is a result of some of the recommendations that came out of that task force. And so I think we'll probably start out, if it's okay, Madam Chair, with a little bit of background about that study, and that'll lay the groundwork for what we have in the bill.
That sounds good.
And I think we'll start off with, Marcus, give me the background. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Mark Michikanis. I'm with the Office of Higher Education, and I have with me George Rodler, who's the manager of the regulatory aspect of the agency. I guess what I would like to do is kind of set the stage, as was mentioned. Talk a little bit about what the regulatory aspect is, and then after that, perhaps Mr. Roller could go by section, if that's your preference.
That's
Madam
fine.
Chair. Okay. Generally speaking, the regulatory goals of the agency are twofold, and of course, this just applies to the non-public schools, both those for-profit and non-profit. And those are financing, make sure that these schools are financially stable, that they can operate on an ongoing basis. We receive financial statements from each of them annually. We review those both with Mr. Roller's folks and with our auditors, who tend to have a stronger financial background. So that's one important aspect on the consumer protection aspect of this function. The second one is educational programming. We want to make sure that the schools have the qualifications and they meet the requirements for the particular degrees that they're offering, whether they're a bachelor degree, an associate degree, a certificate, whatever. If they say they're going to offer this degree, do they have the right kinds of things in place that allow them to actually do that? We do not look particularly at good, better, or best. We don't look at quality. We look at minimum standards, but we do think our standards are strong in those aspects. You, of course, are aware, Madam Chair, this has been an issue for the last couple of years. The difference between the regulation of schools and the regulatory aspect and the licensing of schools, what we have currently in law is kind of a mismatch of sorts, because some schools can have some characteristics, their degree offering, for instance, and can be registered. Others would be licensed. And the difference, of course, is as a licensed school, you have to meet a bit higher standard. We review your books and things like that with a bit more rigor. And this, over the course of time, has not, I think, kept up with the changes in the market. Schools change. They look more like a school that should be regulated, but they're licensed, and they've brought those issues, of course, to you. In the past, as a general statement, the way we've distinguished schools between those that are regulated and those that are licensed is their tax status. If you're a nonprofit school, you're regulated. If you're a for-profit school, you're licensed. And it's not clear to us that that's the right standard to use. We think the educational aspect is probably the more appropriate standard, and that's looking at what kind of degrees you offer, as opposed to something along the tax line. Not to say that the tax status is not important. It certainly is, but we don't know that it's the right standard for these purposes. We have, of course, have had conversations over the last 2 years with a large stakeholder group. Mr. Roller can speak to the particulars about that. Both sides of the for-profit and nonprofit issue, I know that the private colleges on the nonprofit side have continuing concern about the recommendation that you have in front of you. I cannot say that we've solved the problem, Madam Chair. But I think it may be best to hear some of the changes that are recommended to you and decide about how that might address some of the issues that have been raised before the committee. With that, Madam Chair, I would turn it over to Mr. Rodler, unless there's questions on the generalizations.
Hey, Mr. Rodler.
Madam Chair, committee members, Article 5 consists of two parts. The first part deals with sections 136A, which is the registration portion of the statutes. And we've made a number of amendments to 136A. We've changed some of the definitions so that it applies to all schools rather than just to not-for-profit. We've taken any reference to not-for-profit or for-profit out of the definitions.
And you've added out-of-state schools, or were they in there before?
No, the out-of-state schools were always a part of the registration statute if they were coming in and offering classes to Minnesota residents.
Whether they were private or nonprofit.
Right. We have added a reference to out-of-state companies or schools that contract with Minnesota schools or Minnesota companies to provide programs or classes that could ultimately lead to degrees. And that's because of developments recently over the last few years where training firms will contract with out-of-state schools, and they will end up with students who can pay a few extra dollars. That money is transferred to the out-of-state school, and the out-of-state school then provides a test, and they get credit for that. And they can, in some of those instances, end up with associate degrees or possibly even bachelor's degrees from out-of-state schools by taking these trainings.
And so those schools are staying in the registration section?
Well, they're those that have the degrees, because they're the ones that are they're trying to offer credits for degrees that are out-of-state. And we're just trying to get a hold of those people.
Okay. So, Mr. Rowley, just point out the page and lines.
That would be
that.
Section 3 of the definition of school, subdivision 3, school. It's on page 32 at the top.
Number 3, okay.
Right. We have added on page 32, section 5, at line 32.21, an accreditation requirement. And that's something that's never been in any of our statutes. Either licensing or registration previously. And we've required that schools that offer associate degrees or higher be accredited by an agency recognized by the Department of Education for Title IV purposes. And that is your regional accrediting bodies and a number of national accrediting bodies. Total is around, I believe it's 40 or 45 that the U.S. Department of Education recognizes. So that's entirely new. Schools would not be able to offer degrees unless they were accredited.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Just an interjection here. It's my understanding that currently there's only one degree offering program in the state that is not accredited, and they are in the process of becoming accredited.
Right. There are also
Mr. Wilder.
There are also two other brand new schools that are not accredited. They can't be accredited for about another year, year and a half. Both of them intend to become accredited.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sanjan.
And you may have addressed this, but would that also apply to online educational programs?
Yeah, well, there are
privately based.
Yes, the accreditation?
Yes.
Portion? Yes, it would.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Roedler, on line 4 of this page, can you explain to me again why this is just related to in another state? Is the other section relate to in-state?
No, Madam Chair, it refers only to out-of-state because we feel that in-state we would have we would have either the licensing statute or this statute to use, and the ones that are out of state, the training program originator here in Minnesota might be exempt from our license for any number of reasons under the licensing statute, but if they're partnering somehow with an out-of-state degree-granting institution, we would be able to possibly get a hold of them with this and get some regulatory say over them in the registration statute
I just need to get something clear in my mind because of the language. Licensing is the higher level of regulation than registration. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And you did you jump over line 16? Why did you add those words?
I'm sorry, line 3216. That is the current practice, and it just puts in the statute what is actually being done. With registration, we look at degrees rather than specific programs. And in order to look at the degrees, we have to look at the curriculum that make up those degrees, and that's always been done. And we just felt it was a good time to just put that in the statute that that is being done and it should be required to be done. If we go over to page 34, starting on line 3416, the unauthorized representations.
Well, as line 33, that's just changing a reference?
On page 33?
Yeah,
yes.
don't skip over stuff.
Oh, I'm
Tell
sorry.
Us everything you're doing. You all can right, say it's technical, right. It's changing a reference, whatever.
Right. There's a number of technical changes on 33 dealing with references to the statute that have been necessary because of the changes. On line 23 of that page, we've added, or the program of such school, and because we wanted to make sure that the exemption included programs as well as a school and specific programs.
What is this an exemption to?
That is a part of the religious exemption that is in
They are not regulated. Is that what you're saying?
The religious school, there is a religious exemption, a broad religious exemption for schools that are purely religious in nature and or for programs within a school that are purely religious in nature. We have a number of schools that are registered because they have regular general liberal arts degrees or even business degrees, but they may also have degrees leading to priesthood, ministers, and so forth.
Is this something like Bethel College? Or?
Yes, Bethel would be one of them. The St. Paul Seminary
would be
exempt under this.
Right.
And this makes it clear that a program can be exempt even though other parts of the school are not.
Okay.
On page 34, there are also a number of technical changes there. But on line 7, we've added a paragraph to the religious exemption that requires any degree awarded by a religiously exempt institution include descriptive language to make the religious nature of the award clear. And that's just something we wanted to try and be able to differentiate between some of the these are in many instances very small, almost parish-based religious schools, and we want to make sure that somehow someone getting a degree from them, that it's indicated as such by the language that it is in fact a religious degree and not, let's say, a regular PhD.
Did you, on line 9, did you want to say award or degree or award? Or
however they want to phrase it.
Uh-huh.
It would be.
So an award could be more like a certificate.
Well, they say any degree awarded.
Sure.
Okay. So we should change that word to degree.
That could be degree.
Okay. Let's do Senator Senjum moves that on line 34.9. Oh, Senator Roebling can move it, too.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move that on 34.9, the award be struck and degree be inserted.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Okay, on line 12, we have struck the word schools and referred to registered institutions. It's somewhat of a technical change. On going down to line 22 on that page, we have added an additional phrase that schools can use when referring to their registered status with the state of Minnesota. The first part of that is the longer phrase that has been required, and there were some minor changes in that language. And the second part is a very short statement that is easier for some of the schools to, say, put in advertisements or in other publications where they didn't want to take up all the room with the first statement.
Yeah, that statement, the educational programs may not meet the needs of every student or employer. I mean, that seems a little pejorative, kind of.
And that, that has been the language or very similar language to that for many years.
I mean, isn't that kind of course, any educational program may not meet the needs of every student or employer. It's a little, what is that? Do you know the history of that?
I don't know the history.
So you're just transferring language that's already been
existing.
Yeah,
that was language that was in the statute with very minor changes.
Madam Chair, and you know, in some ways that statement could apply to any institution of higher learning.
Right. I mean, I think probably a good idea if there's transfer issues that's in there. But does anybody want to take it out?
Madam Chair, I would move that we remove that sentence, and if you need more clarity into which sentence I mean, why, I can read it. The educational programs may not meet the needs of every student or employer.
Can anybody think of any reason that we should keep that in? Okay, Senator Senjum makes the motion to delete that language. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
And then moving to the bottom of page 34, this line 30, is we have struck some language relating to the retention of student records. There were some inconsistencies between the statute and the rules, and we've inserted language that requires the records for the students to be kept for 50 years. That was the language in the rules, but the statute made a reference to a 10-year time period, and that 10-year time period had, to my knowledge at least, never been recognized. It had always been the 50-year. So this makes that consistent, and the balance of the language on the records is also taken from the rules and brought into the statute.
Madam Chair, this probably is a good idea because if it's said in statute 10 years, that really does have precedence over rules.
Really, yeah.
So even though it's been a practice, it's a good idea.
Well, we're all living so much longer now. I go back and see our school records. They need your transcript when you're 80 and you go back to school.
I'm sure then we better make it 60.
I believe, actually, most of the schools keep them virtually indefinitely at this point. Going down that page, on page 23, line 23 on page 35, a section entitled Fees, and the starting with subdivision 2 and continuing on page 36, we have brought over from the licensing statute a number of fees that are charged. They're like use fees, where if an institution adds degrees, dramatically changes degrees, or there will be administrative fees, and if in fact a consultant is required to review a new degree, the schools will reimburse the office for those consultants up to a specified sum. and that goes down to page line 13 on page 36.
And this is a new process, or
it is the use fees were in a licensure statute before.
Uh-huh.
They were not in registration, and we have brought them over to registration.
Okay, I got it.
Previously, when an institution decided to offer a new degree or to move to a new degree level, we would often have a consultant review their new proposal. And often the consultants would recommend, especially if it was an institution that was only baccalaureate level and was moving to a master's level program, that a site visit be conducted to make sure that they were ready to do this. And the cost of the consultant was always paid for out of the office. The office, the schools paid nothing for that. This now would require the schools to reimburse for that. On line 18 of page 36, we've added a penalty provision that enables the office to levy administrative penalties or civil penalties for violations of the registration statute. This is something that was in the licensure statute and was not in the registration statute. The only remedy available to the office in the registration statute was an injunction to prevent the school from doing something, whatever it was doing.
I'm still back on the fee section for registration fees. So these are colleges or educational programs that used to be in the more highly regulated licensing section.
Right.
But they're being moved to the registration section. So does this impact other educational programs that were always historically in the registration section?
It would depend on the school. If a school that was offering only baccalaureate degree level programs and wanted to offer an MBA, there would be an administrative fee for the MBA, and if necessary, there could be reimbursement to the office for the cost of a consultant to review the MBA program. And that would depend upon whether or not it was what we call a paper review, where the consultant reviews the paper curriculum and proposal from the school, which would be about usually between $300 and $400, or if the consultant had to come and visit the school to be comfortable with making a recommendation. And then in that instance, the fee would be probably around $1,000 plus the usual and ordinary travel expenses for the consultant.
Mr. Rother, can you give me an example of some institutions that this might relate to?
Well, it would relate to any institution that is registered. The primary schools that would probably be affected by this would be the for-profit schools.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to react more quickly to the marketplace than the not-for-profit schools or the state schools that might be registered, out-of-state schools, publics that might be registered. They tend to add degrees or change their degrees more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, they would be the ones that would primarily be affected by this. The not-for-profits are pretty stable in their curriculum. And this would not affect a school that is not going to, you know, frequently change their programs.
Okay. Are we on?
We're still on 17. Page 36. On page 20, on line 24, we just changed the reference to the office. And on line 27, we've now, go back. Line 23 actually starts the reference now to the current licensing statute and the changes that are being made there. That's chapter 141. We have again, starting on line 26, we've made some changes to the definition of schools, removing the reference to for-profit so that chapter 141 will now apply to both for-profit and not-for-profit schools. We've also added the language in 141 referencing the use of college, institute, academy, or university, so that we continue to have those schools regulated to some degree, even if they are regulated by other state agencies. And there are still some out there that do not offer degrees, but they use those terms and historically have used them for many years, particularly a number of cosmetology schools that are use the term institute or academy, beauty academy, things like that. On the bottom of page 37, line 35, we deleted the word may and put in shall. On page 38, on line 24, we've made one addition to the reference to living quarters so that recommended living quarters would now be subject to review rather than just those owned or maintained. We have found that a number of schools do recommend locations for their students to be staying while they're going to school, and with that in mind, we thought that those should come under the review as well as a part of the licensing process. Going to page 39, on line 30, we've added a requirement that in the school's catalogs that the students, that a notice to students relating to the transferability of any credits earned at that school to other institutions is made. Without going into any specific language, this just that it be made. I should add that most of the schools do that now anyway, but it's just one thing we thought should be added. On going to page 40, on line 2, we took out the word issued and put and substituted reissued because it would only apply to schools that had already been licensed. A brand new school coming in for licensure would not have any graduate information or placement information to give us. And on line 8 on that page, we've inserted the word upon request that the placement information will be made available to the student. Going down to line 27, we've added the word approved by the office to the bonding requirement for school records and changed the language somewhat at the end to make sure that the bond runs to the state of Minnesota. Those bonds are for the purpose of any expenses we might have if a school closes, doesn't have a plan, and we have to get a hold of the records and put them on CDs or have somebody put them on CDs, I should say.
What does that mean, the bond shall run to the state of Minnesota? I've never heard that expression before.
It means that the money that's there would be paid to the state of Minnesota. To our office, we would get reimbursed. If a school closed and had, 10 or 15 years of student records and they didn't have a plan and we had to seize those plans, we have to have a way to collate those records, hopefully put them on CDs so that we can find them again and give them to the students, give copies of them to the students so that they can use them possibly at other schools. And this would allow us to make sure that we get any money necessary from the bond, from which the school would provide, to make those records available. Going over to page 41, line 23, the contract or enrollment agreement must not include a wage assignment. That was actually in the chapter 141, but it was in another part of the statute, and we felt it made more sense to have it here in the contract information section. So that has been moved over here. And on line 29, language that was added, a scheduled class or classes, that was added for clarity purposes of the 21 consecutive days to take care of situations where a student wasn't scheduled for a class for 21 days for one reason or another.
Chair?
Senator Latz.
Thank you. Sir, I have a question about that provision. Is that for any cause whatsoever, or are there exceptions such as medical situations or exigent family circumstances?
Well, schools can give students leaves of absence for medical situations or other problems. This is really a provision that is aimed at the student that just disappears, just doesn't show up, and then the school needs at some point to make that determination. And it also helps with record keeping for financial aid purposes, that at that point, if they haven't heard from the student is dropped, and they can start at that point to figure out where the student, any refund of financial aid can be started at.
Madam Chair?
So it should be all scheduled classes.
I think so.
Yeah.
Sir, may I follow up?
Sir Latz.
Thank you. Is there another provision then in a different subdivision of the statute that specifies the leave provisions and that's an exemption to this automatic cancellation?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't believe there is in the statute, not to my knowledge.
Mr. Rodler, what if you have a student who just skips one scheduled class but goes to all the other scheduled classes? Maybe we should say if a student has not attended all scheduled classes, because then it's clear they've dropped out. But if they're just skipping one, it's not so clear.
Okay. Yes, I think that might solve it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's always been the problem.
Right. Maybe there's family emergency or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe we need to work on this language a little bit more to get at what you want to do.
Yeah, Madam Chair,
Senator Latz.
I would agree that with that. I'm concerned that whatever the school's policy is about granting leave, the statute would override a school's policy. So if a school granted medical leave for a month, the statute says, sorry, you are considered to have withdrawn, nothing the school can do about that.
Yeah. And Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
There is some concern, too, about, and I don't know if this would affect them, but our military personnel that might be called up and only have 3 weeks left, or, if they could make arrangements with the institution to make up that work somehow, even though they're not attending class.
Distance or something, yeah.
That we make sure that they aren't considered dropouts.
Because that can affect your, for future classes if you drop a class instead of withdrew from it. Okay, well, we can also try to think of some better language there. That means the staff has to do it.
Going on to page 42, there's been some minor changement. Instrument not to be negotiated, that is on line 3. We've added just accept that prior to that time, the contracts can be assigned with all defenses available. And then the next section, starting at line 6, we get back to the statement that the schools are allowed to use for licensure, and this is a repeat of the same language that was in the registration portion. And that that's the one where we did, I think there was a motion to delete.
Right. Senator Roebling, do you want to delete that language then?
Madam Chair, yes. As long as we can make it consistent, I think we should. So I would move to delete the after the period on 4214 and up till the or on 4215.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
And the balance of that page are just some citation changes. Necessary. And going to line or page 43, one of the exemptions in the chapter was stricken, the driver training schools and instruction as defined. Those schools are licensed under another agency of the state, and there's another exemption within the statute that exempts schools that are licensed by other agencies, and we felt that was just, it was redundant. And then there were other technical changes on that page, changing numbers because of the deletion. And going on to page.
Okay, just a minute, Mr. Roller, going back to 42, Mr. Fuller has a question for you.
Answer, but is that date on line 24 problematic? Because now we're saying that for-profits don't have to be registered or licensed if they're registered that date, but now we're opening it up into the future. Does that create any conflict, or is that okay? Should we change this language to accommodate the fact we're now letting for-profits register across the board if they meet the criteria of the registration statute, or I'm not sure. I just glanced at it.
Yes. Madam Chair,
Roder.
Quite honestly, I have not noticed that. With all the going over this, that paragraph probably should be changed, and references to nonprofit and exclusively baccalaureate removed, because that. Is not consistent with what we're doing.
Can we do that now, or do you need to work with Mr. Fuller later on it?
Let's work.
Okay, we'll work on that later. All right. Okay.
And then I think page 44, the exemption for religious schools, because the Chapter 141 will now have both not-for-profit and for-profit institutions in it. We felt that it was necessary to bring the exemption for religious programs over to 141 as well. It's not certain that schools would want to provide less than degrees on a religious basis, but just in case there would be some, we thought it was appropriate to bring them over here and exempt them from this statute as well. And that language is the same language as the religious exemption that is found in the registration statute.
And so, Madam Chair, on line 4427, we may want to change award again to degree.
Mm-hmm. Senator Roebling moves on line 27, page 44, to delete award and insert degree. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
believe that's the end of the Chapter 141 in PIR statutes.
Now, we still have more things in this bill, so we're not going to take action yet. And we have some people who want to testify. Did you have anything else you wanted to say, Mr. Misconis?
Madam Chair, members, just to, one other comment. This has to do with some of the communications we've had with the Private College Council. They have a number of recommendations that we've looked at that you won't find in the language that's before you now. Some of the recommendations are things that we're doing already, but it may not be to the extent that they think or would prefer. I think that's more of a detail, an implementation issue. And if there are specific questions on those things, we can respond to those as they make those comments too. But we are trying to work with them and come to some arrangements to get to the end.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Letts.
While we're still on Article 5,
mm-hmm.
I've got I've just taken pen to paper and noted some possible language on page 41 for that issue relating to cancellation. And I'll throw it out for consideration. Don't know if you want to adopt it today or not. But
okay. Page 41.
Page 41, line 29.
Mm-hmm.
After 21 consecutive days, comma, insert, and the school has not granted leave or authorized other arrangements for completion of coursework, comma.
So you're, how does the whole sentence read?
It would read, if a student has not attended, I suppose, all scheduled, a scheduled class or classes or all scheduled, I hadn't thought about that part,
mm-hmm.
for a period of 21 consecutive days, and the school has not granted leave or authorized other arrangements for completion of coursework, the student is considered to have withdrawn.
And the school has not granted leave or?
Or authorized other arrangements for completion of coursework.
Other arrangements. Does that make sense to everybody?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I don't think we can put all in, because that means if they skip the class or two that...
I didn't include all in my...
Okay.
There have been some question about all classes versus a class, but that wasn't part of my suggested language.
If a student has not attended a scheduled class or classes, not changing that language yet, for a period of 21 consecutive days, and the school has not taken, has not
granted
leave, a leave, granted leave, granted a leave.
Either one.
It's not granted leave or authorized other arrangements for completion of coursework. This comma, the student is considered to have withdrawn from school for all purposes. Okay, I think we could go with that for
good.
Good for now?
No.
It's not good for now?
No.
Oh. Want to work on it some more?
I think the concept is they haven't been authorized.
Council is going to take your recommendation into consideration and work on the language and bring it back.
That was main purpose for getting it on the table.
Great.
Madam Chair, I had another question or two, if I might. Let's see here. I'm sorry I missed the discussion on page 34 relating to some disclosure statements or unauthorized representations. And I understand that...
Page 34, what line?
Looks like, well, lines 22 to 27. And I understand that the last sentence on line 24 going to 25 was deleted.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if the discussion included this consideration, Madam Chair, but my thought would be that the contents of lines 26 and 27 are basically ineffective unless a prospective student decides they're going to go look up the statutes, and maybe they will, but if a school opts for those instead of lines 22 to 24, then it's to me it's not nearly as helpful a disclosure. I guess it would be my preference anyway, simply to delete lines 26 and 27. And I understand that, you know, the schools may want to have a shorter disclosure, but since one sentence is already deleted from the first option, it's pretty short anyway, three short sentences.
What's the history of having the two different versions?
Madam Chair, the two different versions, actually the shorter version on lines 26 and 27 was in the licensing statute. The longer version, starting on line 22 and going to line 25, was in the registration statute. And as far as I know, both of those sections in the particular statutes go back virtually to square one when those statutes were originally adopted, or language very similar to them. I know they go back over 10 years.
And what you're doing here is you're having the language in both statutes?
Correct. We have put the...
And the reason not to just choose one of the two?
Regulated by different institutions.
Madam Chair, I have
Senator Lantz.
I have an idea maybe for accomplishing both goals here, which would be to take the language on line 27 from pursuant to the end and insert it on line 23 after the word education. So it would say the name of the school is registered as a private institution with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education pursuant to Minnesota statute sections, et cetera. And then it would go on to say registration is not an endorsement. And then that would just be the one disclosure, would make reference to the statutes for the students' purposes if they wanted that more detailed information.
And then what do we do for the licensing section? Do we have a different disclaimer for that somewhere?
Madam Chair, if I might, if that was the way we were going to go, the licensing would refer to pursuant to Minnesota Statutes Chapter 141, and that would be the only difference. One would refer to the registration statutes, and one would refer to Chapter 141. But
I'm
the
sure
rest
I think
of the language
on,
would be the same.
Sorry, I think that's on page 42, lines 12 to 17.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, we may need to delete the last sentence on 14 and 15 as well.
We did.
Oh, you did already. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Is it the desire of the committee that we just combine them and have one disclaimer? Then we can have Mr. Fuller work on that. You got it?
Yeah. Madam Chair, yeah. Senator Lantz is combining the two in the same way. We made his motion.
Okay. Senator Roebling?
Then we end up with something about as long as the first one. And one of the concerns was that for advertising purposes, when they're putting an ad out, that it was a lot to add at the bottom as a disclaimer type of statement. But I agree with Senator Lantz that referring them to the state statutes isn't very helpful. Most people aren't going to go look them up. So I don't know. I don't know if that's maybe we'd be better off putting in a contact for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education in case somebody wanted to follow up on it, or a website or something that they could go to.
Well, and it just seems to me at the point of advertisement, the place to do this disclaimer, shouldn't it be maybe at the point of admission? So students at the point of admission know that, I think the transfer of credits is probably the biggest deal. I mean, why would they even think that the Office of Higher Education would endorse or not endorse an institution? That seems kind of strange to me. I mean, you register an institution. You're kind of neutral. You're a neutral agency and aren't in a position to be endorsing. Does that?
Madam Chair.
You know, the history here must be there was some concern. And I'm not quite understanding what the concern might have been. Mr. Roedler.
Madam Chair, I believe the reason behind this language goes back to a desire to prevent schools from claiming that somehow they were approved by the state of Minnesota or the Office of Higher Education, either by being licensed or registered, that they were only permitted to use specific language. And in the registration side in particular, it was made very clear that the registration was not an endorsement by the institution. And I believe that is where the history.
But there are things that you do approve. There's standards, there's accreditation, there's hoops that people have to go through before they can open a new school here. Now we're saying in order to get the state grant, you have to qualify for the federal Pell Grant. I mean, there are some standards that are there.
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe you're right, but I'm just saying the history. I think history.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound critical. I'm just wondering if this is kind of outdated, this approach, and that the important information to give students might be whether the credits would be transferred to other institutions, and should that happen at the point of advertising or should that happen at the point of enrollment? Is kind of my question. And maybe there's some other.
Madam Chair, hopefully at enrollment or before. And in advertising as well.
I think both.
I should add that the schools are not required in any statute to state that they are licensed or registered. They don't have to use this language anywhere.
Well, I thought it said they have to use it if they advertise.
If they want to state that they are licensed or registered, they must use the language that statutorily they are told to use, but they don't have to say that. They don't have to say anything under the current laws. Other than in the licensing statute, they must list our agency name and address.
Madam Chair?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's something we can work on.
Yeah, let's think about this some more, and also what Mr. Roeder just said I think is very interesting. Maybe we need to work on that as well. Senator Sheeran, would you take over here? And I have to leave for a few minutes, and we can go into the testimony. Excuse me, are there any more questions about this subject? Okay, should we proceed?
We're ready. Yeah, we have other witnesses that have signed up to testify today on this section of this article of the bill.
Very good. Could you help me know who your next testifier will be?
We'll have Jeannie Herman and Michelle Ernst come forward.
Thank you. Jeannie Herman and Michelle Ernst, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee, I am Dr. Michelle Ernst. I'm the current chair of the Minnesota Career College Association and the college director of ITT Technical Institute, Minnesota. My purpose today is to share with you some information about MCCA and the impact our schools have had on the economy in the state of Minnesota. Jeannie Herman will discuss some of our ideas with Article 5. The Minnesota Career College Association represents private post-secondary schools and colleges which are accredited by an accreditation agency recognized by the United States Department of Education and licensed to operate by the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. There are currently 13 school systems within MCCA with a total of 26 locations throughout the state of Minnesota and an enrollment of over 13,000 students. Our membership offers certificate, diploma, associate degree, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and doctorates in a variety of career-specific offerings. MCCA member schools serve a diverse student body. 63% of the students that attend MCCA schools are female. 36% are male. In terms of racial ethnic diversity, 81% are white, 10% are African American, 5% are Asian American, 2% are Hispanic, and 1% are American Indian. MCCA serves a non-traditional and a traditional student population, with approximately 50% of our students in membership schools over the age of 23. MCCA member institutions believe in putting students first. We believe in supporting student access to higher education, providing quality higher education, acting in compliance with all regulatory and accrediting bodies, responding to and meeting emergent workforce needs, satisfying students and their employers with market-focused programs and services, operating with integrity and sound ethical practice in order to benefit our markets, employees, and our communities. Regulations are not new to our sector of higher education. Not only are MCCA schools regulated by the state of Minnesota and our accreditation agencies, but MCCA schools that have locations in other states are also required to meet the regulations of every state that we're located in. In the case of ITT Technical Institute, there are locations in 33 states, which requires the ITT college system to meet the regulations of 33 different states. The for-profit sector has also additional accountability measures that nonprofit schools are not held accountable to. For example, those schools that are nationally accredited are required to submit yearly employment and retention statistics. For those of us that are public companies, we complete disclosures about our schools on a regular basis. Our sector has become transparent, and we are used to being held accountable to standards other school systems are not. MCCA has participated and encouraged the accountability studies that the state of Minnesota will present, and we will be happily participating in them. MCCA is strongly opposed to diploma mills. We feel diploma mills negatively impact students and the higher education industry. As stated before, we require all members to hold accreditation from an agency recognized by the U.S. Department of Education, which is our way of ensuring no diploma mills will become part of our organization. At this time, I would like Jeannie Herman, past chair of the Minnesota Career College Association, to present on the proposed changes from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, member of the committees, I'm really going to speak to Article 5 and what you just heard about. Michelle wanted to have an opportunity, because we know there's several new members on the committee, to give you an idea about who we are. So hopefully that gave you a little bit of background. But with Article 5 and the change in the regulation, we've really been working on it for the past three, 4 years. We've been working with the Higher Education Legislative Committees. We've worked with the Office of Higher Education. And it's really being done to improve the oversight and regulatory law that's in place now. For many reasons that we'll talk through today, a logical means for differentiating between the institutions of higher ed are looking at degree versus non-degree granting status. We do fully support Article 5 of Senate File 575 because we believe it will more clearly define and represent who we are and what we do. The licensing rule that we currently fall under was created years ago, and it certainly was fine then, but it really doesn't match who we are anymore. We were diploma and certificate schools then. We've evolved to associate degree, bachelor, graduate degrees, as Michelle spoke about. This change in regulation will mean more consistent standards for instructional quality, also the credentialing of our faculty. If you look at the standards under 141 that we're currently licensed through, our instructors don't even need to have college degrees or graduate degrees. Of course, we have to follow that through our accrediting bodies, and we do, and we feel strongly about that. But right now, the law doesn't govern that with us, so we want to be represented by a regulation that supports what we're teaching in our schools. We believe this change could possibly aid in transfer of credit for our students, which is something we continually strive for our students. Since our institutions will be following the same standards and come under the same regulations as other degree-granting colleges within our states, we're hoping it may potentially open one more door for our students as they look to transfer credits. We believe it makes common sense alignment with clear division between the degree and non-degree granting. Right now, there are several inconsistencies, which they spoke of earlier. There's beauty schools on 136, and there's, you know, graduate programs on 141. Additionally, I believe it's going to provide clearer information to our consumers. They'll know that those colleges that fall under 136A are degree granting and those that don't are not. And
are more on the technical and vocational side. And finally, I would say the main reason that we support this oversight is the reason that we believe in legislation. And what this does is that it still protects the consumer. The change in moving schools into the logical sections will in no way diminish the level of consumer protection that's afforded Minnesota citizens now. This change will not have any negative effects on the Office of Education's oversight ability to protect consumers. It will not allow diploma mills in our state. And as a benefit, Minnesota will continue to have quality choices of higher education and opportunities for the students in this state.
Thank you very much, Ms. Herman and Ms. Ernst. Are there any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Just one. As one of the new members on the committee, I appreciate hearing and getting some perspective on kind of your part of the higher ed world. But with reference to diploma mills, have we had a Minnesota example or experience of that? Is there something in the Midwest you could point to as an example?
The only example I can cite is when I was searching for a faculty member to teach one of my classes, and I was quizzing him on his doctorate. Mm-hmm. You know, where did you go to school? What did you do? And he pretty much said, oh, I just had to fill out some paperwork and got a degree. That gentleman wasn't hired in our school because you need to graduate from a degree from an accreditation agency that's recognized by the Department of Education. That's the only experience I've had. Mr. Rodler might have more experience with that.
If you do, please come up. If you don't, you can just nod your head no.
Mr. Rodler.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senators. Knock on wood, we have not had a major problem in Minnesota with degree mills. And part of that is the statutes that we have. And we will still have, basically, when these changes are made. They are out there. They're online. We have contact with them similar to circumstances like Michelle was talking about. We do look at schools' faculty when we are reviewing them for licensure or registration. And we have notified schools when we've seen schools' graduates list schools that we know are on the list of known degree mills and notified them of that. But historically, we have not had a major issue in Minnesota like some other states where they have had no regulation in the past. Actually, the state of Wyoming was notorious. They, until last year, they had virtually no regulations. And so there were a number of schools out there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'd also like to talk a little bit about our economic impact study.
And please continue, Ms.
Okay, thank you. At this time, I'd like to share with you information about our economic impact study. In the summer of 2006, MCCA commissioned an outside research company by the name of Maxfield Research to conduct an economic impact study of career colleges in Minnesota. The study was based on data from the 2005 calendar year. There are three key components of the impact study that I'd like to share with you today. First, MCCA member colleges spend money in Minnesota that would not occur without our presence in the state. A major portion of the spending is our operating budget, is for salaries for faculty and staff, which led to the creation of 4,167 jobs in the state. MCCA member colleges contribute to state and local finances through property tax payments, in 2005, paying over $4.9 million in annual property taxes. MCCA schools pay taxes. Second, MCCA member colleges add money to the Minnesota economy through new construction capital expenditures. When an MCCA member school builds a new campus or adds additions to existing buildings, the result is spending paid to external companies like general contractors, architects, and engineering firms. Construction expenditures for MCCA member schools in 2005 was $12.8 million. The construction projects produced 266 jobs in Minnesota in 2005 and was completely funded without any financial assistance from the state or federal government. Third, because of the students that attend MCCA schools, additional income has been brought into the economy through student spending patterns. based on an average annual spending pattern of $11,900. Students at MCCA member colleges spent close to $253 million in 2005. Students spending at MCCA member colleges generate 2,666 jobs in the Minnesota economy in 2005. According to the Occupational Outlook Handbook 2006-2007, 60% of the fastest-growing occupations will require bachelor's degrees and associate degrees. Currently, only 38% of the citizens of Minnesota hold an associate degree or higher. It is vital to the continued growth of the state that we provide students with the choice of higher education, which college fits best for them. MCCA Schools provides Minnesota students with another choice in higher education for the state, and we provide additional income in the form of tax dollars, job creation, and student spending to the state. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak before you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ernst. Did members have any more questions for folks from the Career College Association? And did you already say your position on the legislation?
Mm-hmm. Okay,
great. Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Now we have Meredith Fergus and Rich Forschler from MPCC.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rich Forschler. I'm an attorney at Fabry & Benson and a lobbyist for the Minnesota Private College Council. The president of the Private College Council, Dr. Laird, is out of town today, so I'm a poor substitute for him, so I hope you'll bear with me. I would like to just provide a few opening remarks and then introduce Meredith, who would like to provide you with some suggestions for how Article 5 might be improved. I'd like to, first of all, thank the Office of Higher Education and its staff and its leadership for meeting with us and working with us as we all attempt to improve the regulation in this area. And it was adopted, I believe, in the early to mid-70s, and it is obviously time to upgrade it and to improve it. And I think we're headed in that direction, but Meredith will share some specific ideas with you about where we think further improvement would be a benefit. I think we all share the belief that education is probably the most important service provided to the citizens of the state of Minnesota, so that all of us, those of us who provide the education, and those of you who set public policy for the state of Minnesota, have an abiding interest in this area of law and in having an effective regulatory system. The public purpose, I think, is well stated in the law. You might notice that as you look at the Article 5 that Section 136A.61 is being stricken from the statutes. And we who have been around here for a while know that we have routinely been striking from statutes statements of findings and purpose. And so that one is being stricken. But it actually, I think, states pretty accurately what is probably still, you know, the public intent and the public purpose today, which is to provide the citizens of the state with legitimate and reasonable educational alternatives while protecting those citizens by assuring educational quality and institutional integrity. Education today, of course, as I said, I think is probably one of the most important services provided to the citizens of Minnesota. And I think we also share a goal, you know, that is a goal of having an open and fair educational system, fair to the providers of both traditional and new educational services, and a system that provides to the citizens the educational quality and institutional integrity that can be ensured only by having a rigorous and effective regulatory system. And we obviously have some challenges today, and it is the balancing of that goal with those challenges that is the work of this legislature and the administration and of those of us who are involved in providing education to the citizens. Technology is an obvious new challenge. Web-based, computer-based, internet-based education has provided new challenges with regards to knowing what is being offered to the citizens of Minnesota and assessing the quality and the integrity of those offerings. The economics of the education marketplace are awesome. We devote a lot of resources to education. We as individual consumers of education, we as supporters of those individual consumers, families, government entities, devote tremendous resources to education. So it is an area where there is a lot of economic activity. It's an attractive marketplace, and lucky for us in the state of Minnesota, most people provide very valuable services, but there are in Minnesota and in the United States a few who seek to gain personally at the expense of citizens and governments. So there is a real important interest in doing this well and doing it as well as we possibly can. The concern of the Private College Council is that the proposal, we feel, could be improved even further to provide more protection to the consumers of education services and more assurance that of the integrity of the institutions. Our commitment is to work with you, the legislature, the administration, and providers of education in the education community to improve what has already been presented to you as an improved statute. And with that, I'd like to introduce Meredith Fergus and let her go over a few specific examples.
Thank you, Mr. Forschler, and welcome, Ms. Is it Fergus or Ferguson?
Fergus.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and Senators. My name is Meredith Fergus, and I am the Assistant Director for Research and Policy Development at the Minnesota Private College Research Foundation. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. The Minnesota Private College Research Foundation conducted a review of the existing statutes and policies regarding registration, licensure, and degree-granting authority in the states of California, New York, and Minnesota. All three states have established similar legislation and policies regulating private institutions. All three states have enacted private institution regulation as a consumer protection initiative. The goal of such legislation in each instance is to determine the legitimacy and to ensure the quality of the educational programs offered. But the measures by which such legitimacy and quality are weighed differ. I would call attention today to 13 areas where the proposed legislation before you differs from that currently in effect in California and New York. My testimony will focus on six areas, the majority of which specifically address student consumer protection. In all instances, the New York and California statutes provide their states with more latitude to monitor the performance, educational offerings, and financial stability of their institutions than the proposed legislation. The first area of concern is explicit regulation of admissions and recruitment activities. Restrictions and prohibitions on the use of deceptive, fraudulent, or overly aggressive sales tactics have typically been limited to for-profit institutions. Legislation in both New York and California includes provisions for setting strict standards for ethical admissions and recruitment behavior by the institution and its representatives. While Minnesota rules prohibit the provision of false, misleading, or incomplete information, California and New York also prohibit restructuring of services to avoid regulation and preventing employees from reporting unlawful conduct. Minnesota also does not prohibit compensation for sales or solicitations based on headcount. These can include compensation for student referrals, employee or agent compensation for enrollments or sales of programs longer than 90 days, or compensation to the student for enrolling. New York and California outline a strict standard for behavior by agents and representatives of institutions in a manner that mirrors both the U.S. Department of Education and accrediting agencies. Such a move will ensure that the state has the authority to take corrective action as needed in the absence of or in conjunction with sanctions by other bodies. The second area of concern is ensuring that student recruitment remains separate from student admissions. Recruitment strategies should never override the need to realistically assess a prospective student's strengths, weaknesses, and readiness for college-level work, as well as the college's ability to meet the student's needs. California and New York, unlike Minnesota, prohibit recruiters or solicitors from making admissions decisions. Furthermore, these states have placed restrictions on enrollment of students not qualified for the program's coursework. The use of provisions such as ability to benefit allows students not qualified for coursework to enroll in a program after signing a disclaimer. Such disclaimers should be strictly scrutinized by the state to be certain of their necessity and their ethical use. The third point is that we must differentiate between remedial and degree-granting coursework. New York and California mandate that programs must make clear the distinction between remedial or developmental coursework and credit-bearing coursework. Minnesota does not. No remedial developmental coursework should be used to meet degree program requirements. While students should be given access to needed remedial courses at their institution of admission, students should never be misled into believing that remedial coursework meets the requirements of a degree program. Fourth, students should be provided with a right to know. Minnesota statute focuses on the needs of the state in deterring fraudulent, unethical behavior, or poor quality educational programs from operating. To further ensure consumer protection, New York and California provide students with easy-to-use information, as well as the means by which to seek legal recourse and financial restitution of losses resulting from such behavior. The use of written materials aimed at students outlining Minnesota's current requirements for full disclosure can enable students to have grounded expectations and to make an informed decision. Minnesota can also expand the available measures by which a student may take action against an institution for fraudulent behavior and be granted financial restitution for their losses. Fifth point, utilization of peer review in the regulatory process. New York and California both use a peer review process. Reviewers are drawn from a pool of administrators, faculty, and staff at public, independent, and proprietary institutions. The team evaluates the extent to which the institution and its programs are in compliance with established standards, as well as how well they fit with the state's workforce needs. The final point is that the use of performance-based risk analysis will help identify institutional decline. Identifying financial and programmatic indicators to warn of a potential quality decline is critical given the rate of higher education expansion. New York utilizes a risk analysis approach that allows the state to focus on schools where students are at risk. Indicators that the quality of education may be declining could include things such as rapid changes in enrollment, graduation, or persistence rates, student complaints, or dramatic changes in the proportion of students receiving state or federal financial aid. Trend data can also be used to determine the need to do a further review of the institution. In conclusion, these six areas are important to effective consumer protection and are examples of how Minnesota standards differ from those in comparative states. The remaining areas not covered in the bill before you include administrative resources, grounds for refusal and termination of registration, minimal financial standards, the recognition of not-for-profit status, historical presence in the state, disclosure of pending or outstanding litigation, and ensuring adequate academic support structures for students. Again, these areas are not covered in the bill before you. Minnesota's workforce demands more college graduates, especially those from traditionally underrepresented populations. As the number of high school graduates in Minnesota declines, competition among institutions for students, especially students unfamiliar with educational standards, will only increase. This is the competitive environment in which Minnesota must strictly monitor institutional capacity and behavior to ensure consumer student protection. Thank you.
Thank you for that excellent work that you did. And are there any questions for Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roblin.
I have a question on point five, I believe, utilizing peer review in the regulatory process. Do any accreditation processes not include that?
Ms. Fergus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. I believe that the accrediting bodies do. The one point they don't do is assessing how well the institution will fit what the state needs and the environment of the state. So the state would have would gain some benefit in that manner.
So, Madam Chair, in Rubbling. That sense, all of our programs that we're looking at right now would have to be approved by an accredited association that's recognized by the U.S. government, is my understanding. So I just wanted to say that I think that's in our bill. Mm-hmm. That peer review is in our bill is a requirement.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this article in 575? Okay, then we're going to be doing some more work on that article. And are we ready to move on then, Ms. Hegard?
I just wanted to comment on this bill. I have a little bit of a voice left. that a number of the things that Ms. Fergus and Mr. Forsler brought up are covered under accreditation and under Title IV. And we'd be very happy to take a look at this, to work with staff to try to incorporate some of the interests of the Private College Council in this legislation. I just wanted to say that we're interested in doing that.
Thank you. Then let's move on to the accountability report. Long awaited.
Far back.
John, are you coming tomorrow?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Susan Hegard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And with me, I have Mark Michikanis, who is our director of fiscal policy and research, and Jim Bowie, who is our director of accountability for the office. I'm going to give you do some brief introductory remarks and then hand this off to Mr. Michikanis and Mr. Bowie. This idea first really came to us when we began to look around the country and began to hear about some accountability work that was going on in a number of other states. The governor, in his budget address, included some money for accountability, and we were very grateful that you, Senator Pappas, and your fellow senators and the House members supported our request. And we got $100,000 in the first year and $300 in the second year to put this project together. Both public systems, MinSCU, the U of M, have strategic plans and accountability reports, and I note that the provost from the university, Ms. Tom Sullivan's here, and Leslie Mercer's here from MinSCU today to talk a little bit about that, I'm sure. But they both have strategic plans and accountability reports. So too many individual institutions, both public and private. But missing, however, has been an effort to assess our effectiveness in higher education from a statewide perspective and align state goals with specific measurable indicators. The goal of this report, and there's sort of a national context, too, and I think your seminar you're having or this workshop tomorrow with NCSL and other groups, there's a national context, I think, that's really building support for these efforts. Our goal is to provide information that will help everyone involved in higher education and public policy set targets and employ actions that will make Minnesota a leader and a competitor in a knowledge-based world. We see our role as an agency as collecting information, analyzing it, and disseminating that data and making it available in an understandable way to others. The way that this came together is that after we received the appropriation from the legislature, we hired an independent contractor, Dennis Jones, and his folks from the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, nickname acronym is NCHEMS. And they'd done some work with MinSCU and with others, and they've had broad experience, similar efforts in other states. We had four meetings with state leaders of about 80 people each. I think you brought your committee to one of those meetings. We had 24 meetings in greater Minnesota. We hired Jim Bowie in September. Jim is an EDD, and he's worked at the two-year, four-year colleges, for two-year and four-year colleges, and you know, they're both in the public and private systems. We're told by our contractor that we're one of few states that's developed assessments that align a statewide agenda for higher that align with a statewide agenda for higher education in that Kentucky's one state, North Dakota's the other, and I think we're just the third that's put together something this comprehensive. We're also told that our focus on research is a unique aspect in putting together an accountability report. I'm going to just conclude my remarks here and let Mark and Jim continue. Mark, I think, is going to cover goals one and two. Jim is going to cover goals one and two, and then Mark will cover goals three through five, and I think stand for questions if there's time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, perhaps, I'm not sure if I need to go through this first slide. Ms. Hegard just essentially covered the process that we've gone through for the last year and a half. But again, the one thing to note, though, is we said the timeline that we view this as an ongoing process, one that evolves and changes, and, of course, our intent is to improve it going into the future. Let me just quickly go through the five goals that came out of the process. And I will note, of course, Madam Chair and members, that there are goals of statute for higher education. These were reviewed by our consultant, in looking at these goals and developing the goals that he presented to us. They are, in his opinion anyway, consistent between the two sets. So I don't think that we're suggesting anything in these goals that in any way contradict the current policy of the state, only to say that these goals came out of this process. The last year and a half. The first one, though, is to focus on improving success for all students. And here the key is, of course, students that are traditionally underrepresented in higher education. This would be students from minority groups and those who's first-generation students. So this is, of course, is the goal number one, so we think it is highly important. Second goal is to look at the responsiveness of the system. We want one that we're looking for one, I guess, that is responsive to the economy. You just heard the for-profit school talk about their responsiveness. I think that's important across the whole system, and this became an important goal for consideration. The third goal is to focus on learning outcomes, student learning. This, of course, for those of you that have been around the K-12 conversations for the last 15 years, 20 years or so, this is, in fact, I could suggest going back to 1967 for them, but this has been a focus in our K-12 system. This is part of the conversation at the national level. There are concerns that we don't talk about in this report, but that have come out of some national studies about student learning at the higher education level, and I'll discuss that more as we get to goal three. It's important to consider the contribution to the development of the state's economy. That's through two sources. One would be research. Again, Ms. Seagard mentioned that in alluding to the University of Minnesota. And workforce training, something that the Minsky system is more focused on. And then finally, access, affordability, and choice have always been, I think, key points to higher education and the system and policymaking at the state level.
Madam Chair and members, I would like to just go through briefly some caveats.
Mr. Bowie, would you just introduce yourself for the purposes of the tape?
Yes. My name is Jim Bowie, and I'm the Associate Director for Higher Education Accountability. caveats is probably not the best word, but it was the best I could come up with. This report has definitely been a learning process for us. Those of you that are familiar with the initial NCHEMS recommendation, there were background indicators, supporting indicators, and core indicators, and those of us working on the project decided that it made some sense to eliminate those distinctions and to just talk about indicators. And as a result of that, we changed some indicators slightly. We dropped some indicators after talking with the individual systems who felt, you know, you can have too much of a good thing, and you can indicate things too many ways. You will note as you read the report that a lot of the data comes from 2004 and 2005. There is a lag in adjudicated data that is available that allows us to make comparisons statewide, or not statewide, but nationwide and internationally. So most of the data that we have, we recognize that the systems have already made improvements from the 2004 and 2005 data, but we needed that basis for comparison. So that is where we had to start. Our comparison group, as suggested by NCHEMS, was the top 10 new economy states, and the new economy states measure is developed by the Public Policy Institute. And in the that measure was last updated in 2002. Those states are California, Connecticut, Colorado, Delaware, Maryland, Massachusetts, Virginia, Washington, New York, and New Jersey.
You did it in alphabetical order.
Sort of.
Maryland, Massachusetts.
New York, New Jersey.
New York, New Jersey.
Virginia and Washington. We recognize that there are virtually no Midwestern states in there and very few states that have a population base similar to Minnesota. So we're less than satisfied with some of the results that we have in the comparison group, but we felt it was necessary to move forward with the recommendations we had.
Did you find that there were distinctions, and maybe I might hold questions so we be sure we get done with it, but I'm going to ask this anyway since I'm the chair.
That's right.
With comparison group issues, for example, it seems to me we might have a different cohort of comparison groups if we're just looking at research as opposed to some of the other issues. Or were you trying to find a comparison group that covered all those things?
I assume the goal was to find a comparison group that covered all of those things.
Mr. Just surprised not to see Wisconsin in the mix, since certainly in a research sense, we're compared to Wisconsin a lot.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members, when you have different comparison groups, it certainly does complicate the issue, you know, as far as, so there's some standardization helps, but I think your point is well taken, too.
Okay, continue.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of objectivity, we made every effort that we could to allow the data to speak for itself, to start meaningful policy discussions. So we have endeavored, as a result, not to make value judgments on the data in the report. I'm certain that everyone sitting at the table probably has an opinion and would offer it if asked, but in the report we have tried to remain objective, or perhaps not. And finally, when this committee came to our agency and met, I observed that there were some questions and concerns that I would characterize as the intrinsic value of being an educated person. People asked about, why are we leaving the humanities out? Why aren't we looking at people getting philosophy degrees? And I don't think there is anyone in this room that would diminish the value of those programs. Our focus is on attempting to measure the measurable and to look at things that are going to have the most direct impact on the state's economy, because we believe that's the charge that was given us in the development of this system. Okay. So I am not going to reread Goal 1 to you unless you absolutely want me to. All right. This first slide is full of data, and I want to start off the first three bullets under this thing that I call rate data really kind of paint a pathway, if you will. It's not a perfect pathway, and I'll talk about some of the pitfalls. But the first item is college participation. This is defined as the percentage of high school graduates that go directly on to college. And in 2004, for Minnesota, 65.3% of our high school graduates went directly on to post-secondary education. The national average was 55.3%. We rank fifth in the nation on this indicator, and we have moved up significantly since 1990. The next piece, once we get them there, do we get them to stay? And when we're talking about retention rates, we are really talking about first to second year retention. It's important that for both retention and graduation rates that you understand the way they're computed. These are computed based on first-time, full-time students. So now there is a part-time retention rate that's also reported. We did not look at that as closely. But for first-time, full-time students at the two-year institutions in Minnesota, roughly 56.9% are staying into the second year. At the four-year institutions, roughly 78.3%. Retention is important because research shows that if students stay between the first and the second year, they are more likely to stay and finish college. What can impact student retention? Again, I mentioned the fall cohort. I also would tell you that people who register in the previous summer are counted in that fall cohort, and that if a student completes a program that's less than a year, they're counted as being retained. So if you go to a two-year school, you complete a one-year certificate or a one-year diploma, you're counted as being retained into the second year.
Are we, was probably part of the ongoing work in determining why we're not retaining students.
Yes.
See, that seems like important information.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And I would assert that retention is an issue that's being paid, great attention is being paid to retention in colleges all across the state and the country. Majority of students who do leave will leave within the first year. So, now, for the two-year rate, I wish to echo some of the concerns of Minskew in that if a college has what we would particularly refer to as a transfer mission, then two-year retention numbers are obviously going to go down because students that transfer do not count as being retained. They're counted as being transferred. So some of...
Even if they stay for 2 years?
No.
Only if they transferred earlier.
If they transfer after the first year.
Okay.
So.
All right.
Moving on to graduation rates. This, again, is based on a full-time, first-time cohort that enters in a fall. Mm-hmm. And then the three-year graduation rate for two-year institutions is computed as the number of those students that finished a program within 3 years of entering. Four-year rates are for four-year schools. Six-year rates are for four-year schools. Now, okay. Graduation rates can be negatively impacted by a number of factors. Transfer outs negatively impact graduation rates. Transfer ins do not help graduation rates because they're based on a first-year full-time student. If a student switches to part-time or changes majors late, that can have a negative impact. First to second-year retention and graduation rates are at least partial indicators of success of institutional recruitment efforts. Research shows that failing to retain and ultimately graduate students carries a cost in terms of program development, in terms of recruitment costs, in terms of lost tuition revenues when students leave.
And does it even contribute to their employability? That's a question, too. An incomplete education, can
absolutely.
You get as good a job as if you complete?
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. Okay, the final fact and figure that I would want to show you has to do with the proportion of our population between the ages of 25 and 34 holding a post-secondary credential. We chose this age range because it allowed for the most complete set of comparisons nationally and internationally. At the associate's level or above, almost 49% of this group in Minnesota has an associate's degree, as opposed to 38.4% nationally. If you refer to the report on page 18, no, not page 18, page 21, you can also see some international comparisons, and we compare very favorably at the associate's degree level and above. The next point I would like to draw your attention to is the achievement gap. The primary purpose of Goal 1, as Mr. Michikanis alluded to, is looking at the underrepresented groups in higher education. Part of this focus is on students of color. And this slide shows that they are not completing degrees in as great a proportion as they are enrolling in the institutions. And in particular, they are pursuing lower-level pre-baccalaureate programs at greater rates than they are baccalaureate programs. On the next slide, we look at the critical fields, which were identified as STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and healthcare. And what this is, what this number represents, this is not saying, for example, that 40% of the diplomas and certificates in healthcare were earned by students of color. This is saying that 40% of the certificates and diploma earned by students of color were in healthcare. Because otherwise, those two numbers should add up to 100%, and they clearly don't. So again, we do have a situation where we can see that students of color are pursuing STEM programs at a greater rate than Caucasian students, but not necessarily so in the health field, certainly at the certificate and diploma level. There are a number of reasons for this. There's obvious economic reasons because these are fields that pay very well upon graduation after a short term. Moving on to Goal 2, if you look in your report, Goal 2 has 20 charts. I am not going to show you 20 charts. Instead, I'm going to show you charts that aren't even in the report. In creating a responsive system that produces graduates at all levels who meet the demands of the economy, again, we were focused on the STEM and healthcare fields. The initial NCHEMS report suggested education as a field we might want to look at. Getting data on education graduates is virtually impossible because of the way that IPEDS data is collected and the way that institutions report. You can call three different schools and get three different answers how they report education graduates. So we'll start, and basically we're looking at all of these level by level. So here I'm looking at certificates, diplomas, and associate's degrees. So again, pre-baccalaureate credentials. In STEM, we see a pattern where we were kind of low in the early 2000s. We spiked in 2003, and we're heading down. We're talking here a lot about the dot-com bust and other factors that have affected this. If we stack health upon top of that, we can see that the proportion of degrees, and proportion is a good way to look at this because it tells us whether or not students are pursuing them. We also look at this per capita so that we can say, are we meeting the needs of the state? Clearly, the proportion of health certificates and other pre-baccalaureate programs has held steady and started to increase. When we compare that to the national average of those two items combined, we see that the state is doing actually very well at this level, and we are definitely outperforming the new economy states.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I found it funny, too, and I looked at that a number of times.
They're all getting philosophy degrees.
That's right.
Madam Chair, would you explain what it is that you're finding funny there, or talk a little more about it?
Well, we're looking at the chart on page 10, and that's up there, right?
Yes.
I thought, since we're being compared to these top 10 economy states, that's the little triangle.
Yeah.
It's below the national average, and we're above the national average. So you would have thought that in the top 10 new economy states, they would have all been at the top here with us. That just didn't kind of make sense.
Clearly, one potential explanation is this is two-year programs and less.
Ah.
And it may be that other states have a more demanding standards for healthcare certification or something like that. So there are factors that could explain this.
Okay.
Moving on to the bachelor's degree level, we can see that STEM degrees have held kind of steady. Again, with some drop-off, bachelor's degree level in healthcare has also held steady but is probably particularly low. And we really start to we're starting now to see that we're falling behind the national average here, and the new economy states are starting to move up. It becomes even more apparent when we move on to the master's level. I've heard testimony from Minskew faculty talking about the lack of master's degrees in nursing, so that we have teaching faculty, and clearly that's evidenced here. And we can see that gap in particular in 2005 ought to be particularly troubling to us. And then finally, at the doctoral level in STEM, it's worth pointing out that the majority of the PhDs in STEM fields in this state are being awarded to foreign nationals, which is actually true in most states in the nation. But it's even the proportion of white students is fairly low on this indicator. Health degrees would include doctors, dentists, veterinarians, as well as people getting PhDs in health disciplines. But again, you can see that we are starting to fall behind.
Right, and it makes you think of things like we do so well in the beginning 2 years, but then maybe there isn't a career ladder for those folks. Thinking, okay, now you've got your certificate, your 2 year, what's next? How do we move you then to a 4 year degree, and then how do we move you to a master's, et cetera?
Chair, I believe that's a very good point.
Senator Roblin.
Is there any indication as to how many of the foreign nationals stay here and continue working?
Madam Chair and Senator, I do not have specific data on that, but I will look that up.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, I'll deal with the next three goals, although I am mindful of the time, and I know there's some other people here to testify, so I can rush through them and just pick on the key points.
I think you should do that because I think we can talk about this more tomorrow at our workshop, too.
Okay. Just on goal three, there is no current indicator here because there's not available, obviously, but we are aware of a number of attempts around the country to do this work, and we are also aware of a number of attempts at the institutional level to do this work, so it's an important part of the consideration of this effort. Goal four deals with research and workforce training, and I'll admit up front that we do not have indicators for workforce training. Again, this was a question of measuring the measurable, and none that was satisfactory. On a comparative basis, were available. Certainly at different institutional levels and the system levels, there is some information. But again, this is comparable work, so absent that data, we had nothing to present to you. We do have three research-related goals. The first is a ranking of academic research, and this is data from the National Science Foundation. And what you see is our percent share of the total academic research through the years shown. Let me make very clear, though, typically you'll see this kind of information only for the University of Minnesota. We've included research dollars drawn down from NSF and NIH for the Mayo Institute, Mayo Clinic. You heard testimony from them yesterday. Clearly they are an educational institution, and they draw research money from the same source that the University of Minnesota does, so we thought it appropriate to include them here, although typically they're not included in academic research. You can see that we do fall far short of the top states. I'm not sure that's the goal. The goal here is probably more trend data. Are we improving in our share over time? That's probably the most important perspective on this particular indicator. The next indicator is simply a set of rankings from a number of studies. One is the University of Florida. This is national rankings, institutions within the country. And it is group data. It's in the report. You can see a table there. It includes both private and public institutions, but we've clearly identified those so you can distinguish those. And because it's group data, I'm not sure that the statement says we're tied for the 15th is the most accurate, but you can see that we fall in about the fourth group within that data set. There are some international comparisons available as well. We wanted to bring those to your attention because the university's goal, I guess, is to be one of the top three research institutions in the world, so we thought these were important, at least to bring to your attention. I know that the university is aware of these. I've seen reference to them in various reports. But again, we haven't spent that much time with them making sure that they are fully cover all the aspects that we'd be concerned about. So this is kind of an informational thing as much as anything. Mm-hmm. And then finally, there's a contextual question about research. Research just doesn't happen at Mayo or the University of Minnesota. In fact, it happens mostly in the private sector. Total research money in the state in the last year reported is about $5 billion. Mm-hmm. Almost 87% of that happens in the private sector, Medtronics, 3M, things like that. Mayo is a very big contributor. They draw down about $170 million roughly from NIH, so they're very important. So this kind of contextual thing, I think, is something that we wanted to bring to bear on this report so that you have a sense of how the pieces all fit together.
And is that private sector research included in these rankings, or this is only public research dollars?
Madam Chair, in this last slide, it is everybody. In the first two, it was not. It was just the academic research. The last goal, dealing with access, affordability, and choice. Let me deal quickly with this one. This shows net tuition by income quintile, comparing Minnesota, the new economy states, and the national average. Net tuition is the sticker price less all grants, whether they're from the government, which would be the Pell Grant, state grants, or of institutional aid. So this is the price the student is actually paying along these income lines. You can see that up through $75,000, Minnesota is actually below the national average by different amounts. It's about the same between $75,000 and $106,000. And then at the highest income levels, we expect more from students than is true at the national average. In each case, Minnesota is below these new economy states. It's not quite clear to me what that suggests, Madam Chair, if that's a goal or not. But.
Right.
Be more tuition. Madam Chair, I'm going to spend maybe not. Although I should say, hopefully, those people are getting more for their money if they're spending more. In any event, I want to spend a bit more time with this next chart because it is very complicated, but it contains an awful lot of information. This has to do with the state grant program and what we expect from families, not from students, but from families through the lowest three income groups, the first 20%, the second 20%, the third 20%. Over this period of time, from 1986 to 2004, and again, this is a policy matter. It's a state grant expected family contribution. For the lowest income group, you can see that through 1995, the expectation was a zero contribution. In 95, that grew to about 1.8, and it stayed roughly there, dropped a bit in 04. Madam Chair, I think this may not seem like a big percentage change, but to my way of thinking, this is a significant change. The way I've talked about this in other places is that if you change the tax rate from the lowest rate and add a percent and a half to it in the tax committee, the conversation would be very interesting. Going from 5.5% to 7% as the lowest income tax rate. Yet this has happened within this policy structure without people talking about it. So I think this is an important way to think about this. The next line then shows the second lowest income group. It is higher. But again, you see the same kind of a trend upwards. I should mention both of these lines, this chart also includes data for five sectors. And for the first two income groups, the expected family contribution rate is the same, whether it's public or private, profit or nonprofit.
Mr. Misakonis, just a clarification. Is this percent of family income?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. So we expect for the second chart, roughly 6% of a family in 04 to spend of their adjusted gross income for higher education under the state grant program. And then let me just add the other five lines here. There's diversion in the next three lines. The next five. So it kind of shows you what happens under the state grant program, how we expect different amounts from families at different income levels. Yeah. Madam Chair, I can come back to this next week on the state grant program.
Okay.
I would say it just real briefly, and you, of course, Madam Chair, know that I've been around you for a long time. I claim this is the best public policy chart I've ever seen in my career, so I think it's pretty nice. Let's move on then. This is just a borrowing chart. Let me mention two take-home points from this. This compares borrowing, cumulative borrowing for Minnesota with the U.S. average. Those are the bars. The lines indicate the percent of students that are actually doing the borrowing. So at public 2 years, nationally, 29% of students borrow. Minnesota's 52%. And in Minnesota, the borrowing is roughly about $900 higher. So in all cases, we tend to borrow more money in Minnesota, and more of the students do borrow money. We're trying to understand why this is the case, what it has to do with. There is some indication that because we're essentially a wealthier state, we tend to borrow more. Our personal income is higher, although that's not the best reason to me. We do have some information at the two-year level that that borrowing may be higher simply because the tuition rates are higher. Madam Chair, I believe that's it for the five goals.
Great, thank you. It's been a long time coming, and there's a lot of data that goes into these few charts that are in this. And tomorrow, I think we're going to be learning more about what this data means in light of kind of some national, international comparisons and how we can maybe put together and get legislative buy-in to an accountability system. So let's hear from briefly from a few people who wanted to comment on this first report. And certainly we can give you time at a later meeting if we don't get through a lot of comments here. Leslie Mercer or Raminskiw. Associate Vice Chancellor.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Leslie Mercer. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor of Research and Planning at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I will be brief in light of the time. First of all, on behalf of the Chancellor and the Board, we just wanted to say that we have appreciated the process that has led forth to this report. We've appreciated being involved in it, and we think that that the report does a good job of distinguishing between what are some state level accountability measures and complements nicely the kind of accountability framework that we have at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. So we see no disagreement with that. In fact, we see great comparability. We also appreciated in the presentation today and in the text of the material that it does many times give some context for some of the information. One particular thing I would draw to your attention that we are particularly want to recognize is the difference between 2 and 4 year students and the missions of those institutions. Graduation rate as an indicator of quote-unquote success especially for our college students, is not always the only or the best indicator. As you know, many of our college students are part-time, they're older adults, they're working, and graduating in 2 years or 3 years is not necessarily their goal. And so we appreciate the fact that this report, while it uses graduation, does try to put some context around that. We are anxious to work with the Office of Higher Ed and with you all on developing some measures of workforce, since that's something that we as a system feel is one of our primary goals, is the preparation of employees and workers both in the short term and in the longer term. So we look forward to doing that. Our own accountability framework does have some measures. We use a median salary of our recent graduates. We use related job placement, and we use the number, the percentage of students that go on and are enrolled concurrently while they're working as some indicators of job effectiveness and preparation, but and we're open to talking more about that. The other thing that I would just like to note is that we feel that this is very compatible with our own board's strategic goals and priorities. The STEM area is an area our board has identified as being very, very important to us. Healthcare is another one. The achievement gap between underserved students and our majority population would be a third. And so we feel that this is very consistent with what we think are our priorities. And I would just happen to note that it's very consistent with the budget request that our system has made in terms of funding for STEM, for healthcare, and for bioscience. I think with that, I will just stop. If you would like for us to talk more at some future date, we'd be more than glad to do that. So thank you for this opportunity.
And are you joining us tomorrow, or who is joining
us? Yes, I am. I'll be glad. I'm very pleased to be able to say I'm joining you tomorrow.
Thank you. Provost Sullivan.
Madam Chair, I'm Tom Sullivan, Provost at the University of Minnesota, and I will just abbreviate my remarks to underscore what my colleague has just said. We at the University of Minnesota very much appreciate the leadership of Susan Hegard and her colleagues. We think this is a terrific report. They have worked very collaboratively with all of us in higher education in Minnesota, and we're very, very grateful for the lead that they have taken. While we don't perhaps agree with all of the details, we do strongly endorse the need for the state of Minnesota and our colleagues in higher education to take important steps to make sure that there is strong accountability, and that responsibility is put on each of us who run these institutions. At the institutional level, the University of Minnesota, as you know, has been engaged in measurements and performance for some time. We have had an accountability report for the last decade, which is annually reported here at the legislature. The university agrees with the underscored points in this report, namely that education in Minnesota is the key. There is no question about that. The higher education systems, all of us in this institution, need to set ambitious goals. We need to track our performance. We need to improve consistently and aggressively. And we need to have the flexibility to be able to adjust to changing conditions and workforce needs as we go forward. And finally, on that point, I would just add, I think all of my colleagues would agree, and we've heard it mentioned several times here this afternoon, of the importance of transparency for everything we do in higher education, particularly public higher education in Minnesota. I would just like to mention two of the five goals and underscore 2 points for you. With regard to goal number two, which is educating a productive citizenry, I would caution the committee that simply tracking the number of degrees isn't going to get us very far. We need to have a more sophisticated approach than merely looking and tracking at the number of degrees. I think all of our experience, regardless of the nature of the institution we come from, suggests that the agility and the flexibility to be able to adjust and to meet different workforce needs is critical if we are going to be successful in leading the country with outstanding products from higher education. The second point I would make is with regard to goal number three, and that has to do with learning outcomes that my colleague just mentioned. I would caution that each of our institutions, as you have heard this afternoon, regardless of where we come from in higher education in Minnesota, each of us is unique and distinctive. And each of us has a very different mission, be it in the public sector or in the private sector. And because of that, we have different students. Those aspirations of the students are different. We have to be careful that you permit us to tailor-make our student learning outcomes to fit the mission, the values, and the goals of our institution. This is not to say that we should back down in any way from all of us being required in an accountability standpoint to have student outcome performance measures. Very important. But I think the uniqueness and the distinctiveness of each of our campuses must be taken into account. At the University of Minnesota, we have been working now for 3 years on student outcome measures. Last week at our University Senate, they were presented. In 2 weeks, I will present them before our Board of Regents. We're very excited about these student outcome measures, and at some point, I would be happy to come back and share those in depth when you have more time, because it is one of the most important things we're doing in this teaching, learning experience that we're undertaking at the university. Finally, I would just note that all of us, I think, again, regardless of the public or private sector nature of our day jobs, all of us are working very hard on the affordability side, the access and affordability side of our students. At the University of Minnesota, we have nearly 21,000 students every year that receive scholarships, fellowships, or financial aid directly from the university. And I know my colleagues from the other institutions have similar numbers to support how we are attempting in this cost of rising tuition, how we're attempting to make sure that our students still can afford our universities and graduate in a timely manner. In conclusion, we highly recommend for your consideration the Office of Higher Education's very important work. It's path-breaking, we think, as Susan Hegart said a moment ago. And once again, Minnesota is leading the country, we think, in these kinds of accountability measures that are so important. We support them and we embrace them. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those comments. Did someone from the Career College Association plan to comment, either Ms. Ernst or Ms. Herman? Ms. Ernst? And while she's coming up to the table, I just wanted to remind members of our workshop tomorrow. We want to start sharply at 9 o'clock, so if you want to get your coffee and muffin, come a little early. And if anyone needs directions, I don't know if Katie has sent out directions. Directions have been sent out. So it's only a couple miles from here to the east. Great. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. MCCA, as well as the other folks that have testified, agree that this accountability study is very impressive. We've supported it through the whole process and appreciate the opportunity from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education to contribute our thoughts and ideas to it, and look forward to working with the Office of Higher Education as it continues to evolve. Many of the goals we have already been doing as a sector of higher education. I will inform you that, and this might not be a surprise to many of you, that research is